Hello everyone and welcome along to another edition of the podcast. Appreciate you hitting on the button once again. This is, I guess, going to be theoretically a creative podcast, a business podcast, but there's going to be a good thread of sport after speaking to our guest on the phone. They had a great chat. It is Miles Dunkley, who's the CEO and Chief Creative Officer of SLG, which is a fast expanding company in the heart of Cheltenham Town. Miles, you're a Gloucester man yourself, but just tell us a little bit about the company rather than me trying to describe it, because it's been an evolution.
Well, it has, and actually we're 35 years old, or I say 35 years young, really, because the company was founded in the mid 80s by my mum and my dad. They built a business manufacturing cosmetic applicators, makeup sponges, essentially. Quite niche. I joined the company about 20 years ago. My career was in design industry, packaging design, brand identity, creative industry, really. And I joined up, and really the company has kind of, I think, manifested itself now today into more what the industry I left than the business my parents started 35 years ago. So what we do, we design, we develop, we market, we build, we distribute beauty brands and male grooming brands, very much targeted towards young consumers, Gen Z, millennial, and always with a sort of fashion edge and a kind of cool, funky vibe. That's kind of SLG.
Yeah, cool, funky vibe. And if you do hear any rustling, we have to apologise, because we're sat on beanbags in the chili bean room, which is very atmospheric. We've got lamps hanging down from the ceiling. We've got great views, actually, out of a window here, and hammocks inside as well, kind of soft tones. But this is all part of the revolution of SLG, hasn't it? I think you've taken it on possibly from your father as this design edge, not only in what you're doing, but in how you're living and working now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's happened, we've recently moved into this new premises, Studio 19 at the Brewery Quarter, where we undertook quite an ambitious interior design project to accommodate the company, 100 people, up to 120 with the freelance crew. And being a design-led business and one that puts creativity at really the heart of what we do, we felt that our offices and our workspace should sort of reflect that visually. And so we've deployed a lot of kind of creative ideas in the execution of this office space.
And we met at the Cheltenham Wellbeing Festival, which you were chief sponsor of that as well, which was fascinating. But part of the revolution here is, you know, it's full of kind of American themes. You've got the skateboards on the wall, you've got the booths, the diner, the bleachers, which for people who aren't familiar with American sport, is where, you know, the stands where people watch American sport from, where you have your big kind of symposiums and meetings. And we had the wellbeing events as well. But a big part of this was to make people feel good at work, wasn't it?
It was. I think as a company, we've always regarded our staff as being the key asset of the company. But what we were able to do here was really to explore lots of kind of well-being notions in the execution of this office. And it became a sort of viral thing for us, really, because as we started to think about an office space as a place for people to enjoy, to be motivated in, to feel good in, we found lots of ideas breaking free. We also were lucky we had an awfully huge space to play out some of those ideas.
27,000 square feet or something.
Yeah, right? I mean, the whole is over that, actually. We subcontract 7,000 to a community workspace project, but the actual office that we occupy presently is 27,000 square feet. Actually the biggest open plan office space in the southwest of England, I have been told.
Wow.
So we're very proud of that. But I wouldn't say we discovered well-being on the journey of creating Studio 19, but we certainly became very conscious of it and started to adopt a lot of ideas that would be about staff well-being. And in fact, we discovered things along the way, like biophilia, which is the innate human sort of a tendency to want to be near nature and natural things. So plants are everywhere.
Tropical plants as well, aren't they?
Exotic. Well, yeah, and in fact, the tropical nature of the plants was quite key, because what we were trying to do there was to create a sense of escapism, possibly. Big leafy plants that one might find on a holiday, and to, I think, create a different sort of world atmosphere when one walks into this particular premises.
Yeah, and it's interesting the plants came out of it, that feeling of well-being that's connected to nature. But also I know that Ben Channon, the architect, was on the panel with us, and he's done a lot with mental health and well-being and aspects of architecture. He immediately noticed the kind of floor-to-ceiling 20-foot, 30-foot windows you've got in here, which even on a grey October's day today is letting in an enormous amount of daylight, which not only is it said to be better for your general mood state, but also sleep and things like that, which is a key part of, I guess, your staff's performance.
Yeah, we're very lucky with this space. Almost half of it is full height windows. I mean, it's tremendous. And that natural light, that's part of the biophilia, the kind of connection with nature and natural things.
Well, the plants need it as well, which we're part of nature as well. I suppose that is interesting, yeah.
Absolutely. So we get these wonderful sunny days where the light casts through beautifully. And even on dull days, it's still really bright.
Yeah.
I think that's a wonderful thing. We're lucky to have that.
Yeah.
And we make best use of it.
Yeah, I can definitely imagine appreciating that, because I'm in 4 or 5 hours broadcasting in a studio without any daylight, which is kind of a leveller for whoever's on watch shift, because there's no daylight either way. So it can feel like a graveyard shift. But I noticed that profoundly, that, you know, that need to get outside after you've been in a room with no daylight.
I've experienced that when I was employed before I was in the family company. I worked in some very dingy offices, actually. I wasn't very conscious of the fact they were dingy. I just recall feeling dingy and down myself to some extent. And then as we started to explore over the years our own offices of SLG, we kind of opened up a little bit to that kind of idea of light, and my previous office definitely had that, and this has it in abundance, and it's really uplifting. It's wonderful, actually.
Yeah, something came out of the Wellbeing Festival for me was almost the perception, like, we wonder why certain people don't exercise or don't do that, but sometimes you think people are in a state of not being very well, that they're not aware of the effect. Like you say, being in a dingy office, maybe it's something kind of subconscious that you think you just feel a bit under the weather and a bit dreary.
I'm absolutely sure that's the case. We're also lucky because our next door neighbour here, but one, is a gymnasium, a gym. And so our staff, we have a discount with the gym, DW, and so we're actively encouraging our staff to participate in exercise. We have showers in the bathrooms here at Studio 19 as well, so anyone wants to...
And quite the bathroom as well, they've got your hair gel in there as well.
And we've got all the products, yeah. I mean, we're a beauty company and male grooming, so we would, you know, I guess it would be only right that we would make our products available. We've got Dyson hair dryers and hair straighteners for the ladies as well. So we're all in on that kind of aspect, the showers as well. And we've also used the sort of event space, which has the bleacher stand in it, for yoga on a Thursday, which is a complimentary offer from SLG for all staff.
Do you do yoga? Have you done yoga?
I do, but I actually don't do the one at SLG, because I wonder how many, particularly the females, perhaps want their CEO in a leotard or something. Yeah, so I do Pilates, actually, but I do that more privately, off-grid, in my own home.
That dynamic leadership is interesting, because you're aware of that. And I know, as a sports broadcaster, that's always an interesting dynamic, particularly... say in management, when assistant coaches who go between the managers and the players, who have a relationship with both, suddenly get catapulted to that top role, that they then have to maybe create a distance or an awareness of how they can affect being around people, and might, you know, put them off being able to relax sometimes if you know the boss is there. And it's interesting, because obviously well-being was where we connected, but chatting the other day, and this podcast is called Sport and Life, and it can be other topics outside of sport, but it's often how many times is a sport thread to it, particularly in business, and how, you know, people who are business leaders have had sometimes a background in sport, and yours as well. As I think the American themes we hear with skateboarding was a big rugby part of growing up, wasn't it? That was a thread of your youth.
It was, although it started with football, really. My dad was a massive, keen football player, played a lot of football, semi-professional, Gloucester City and Brentford. So I grew up in a football household. It was only when I went to got to age 12 at school where we started playing rugby rather than football that I became really a rugby guy, I guess. And also I feel kind of privileged. I was born half a mile from King's Home. I could hear the shed from my garden, and I feel that's the equivalent of I don't know, being a Cockney and I hear
West Ham or
within earshot of the sheds, you're a proper Gloucester guy. And I was fortunate enough to I was selected for Gloucester Colts, played one game against Richmond on the bench. I didn't get on. But
what position did you play as a rugby player?
Well, I played anywhere in the back line, to be honest. Fly half when the team wasn't so good, and on the wing when the team was really good.
They're kind of the brains of the team, that the fly half and the scrum half of the Axis, aren't they?
It is. I think it's a very creative role there, and I like the artistry of fly half. But when I was amongst really good players, I tended to get pushed out on the wing or a fullback, something like that. So I sort of grew up with football. My dad, who was a great entrepreneur, adopted entrepreneurial kind of approaches to running the first football team I played in, which he set up.
Yeah, and what position did you play in football?
Well, I was a centre half in football. As I got older in my adult life, when I had the last sort of foray with football in my late 20s, early 30s, I went into midfield.
Started running things.
Yeah. A sort of Jan Molby just stood there, you know, hoping the game came to him rather than the other way around.
Well, no offence to Jan, who's a wonderful player, but you're very svelte, to be fair.
I didn't have much of an engine. I tended to hold my position, let's say, that much.
Yeah, Jan's remarkable, actually, thinking about sort of the modern era of sports science, how kind of big he was, but obviously worked for him in terms of performance. I suppose that's the thing, is that people of all sizes, particularly in football, kind of work. And it was through there you met a leader and a former Scotland international, wasn't it? Your coach at school with rugby. Mm. And that's interesting, because for me growing up, I was at school when the professional era came in. But before that, and it's not to deride the guys that now go into professional rugby at 18 without life experiences, but what you find from the former generation, people like when I was a kid, Brian Moore, Will Carling, Roy Underwood was in the RAF. They all had jobs, and Brian Moore was a barrister. So there's a kind of, I guess, a depth to their roundedness and how they could articulate the importance of sport, wasn't it? But you had an influence like that from a person who had top honours, but also was a teacher.
That's right. In fact, I've learnt an awful lot from the coaches as a young boy who coached me. My dad being the first one, actually. As I say, he was the coach of the under-12s football team that he put together. And then at school in rugby, it was a chap called John Simonet, who was the head of games. He was a Gloucester player, number 8, and also a Scotland international. So, and he was a big number 8. He was a big character.
Physical, yeah.
His nickname was Psycho, and that tells you everything you need to know. But everybody respected him, listened, and hung on every word that he said.
He's done public speaking, isn't he? I believe, is that
yes,
right?
That's what he went on to do. Funny enough, he left. He was a biology teacher as well as games and rugby in particular, obviously. But he went on to become a close quarter magician. Mm. And a public speaker, so that's an unusual transition from rugby player to teacher to entertainer.
Such a commitment, though, isn't it, when you think about it now? To, you know, we think about kind of having a job and commitments, but having a job and being a pretty much full-time athlete at a really high level is complex at that time.
Absolutely. Another twist to that story was that he left King's School to pursue this career in entertainment. My mother was a major catalyst for that, because she ran an entertainment agency in London at the time, and she got him his first job outside of working for at the school as a magician on the very first Virgin Atlantic airline flights. Yeah, when they only had one aeroplane, and he was on there doing magic tricks during the flights.
So shows you how glamorous it was in the initial days. I still remember in the 80s, 90s, we lived in the West Indies and Virgin, having the backpacks and the paraphernalia. It was quite glamorous, wasn't it?
In the early days. I think it's probably less so now, but certainly back then.
Yeah, being a magician is fantastic. And what did you think you picked up from rugby and playing sport, which perhaps has helped you as a leader and a team member as well?
Well, I think I'd look to the coaches, really, and reflect back on how they were. My dad, under 12s, he put together a team. He led the team. He taught me a lot about how to assemble a group of people and get them functioning. He taught me a lot about celebrating success collectively and individually. He used to have a thing where the player, the man of the match, would be given a pack of Rolos and would be allowed to sit in the front of the car we all used to travel around in, because he used to somehow get 10, 12 players in the Ford Granada estate, very illegally probably, but the front passenger seat was reserved for the man of the match.
There were no rules about seatbelts and stuff in those
there
days.
There wasn't, no, and there seemed to be very little rules about anything when I reflect back.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing. We were a very bad team in the beginning, and then We got better and better, and he demonstrated entrepreneurial skills, I feel, by picking better players as the season went by. He kind of assembled a sort of Real Madrid Galacticos in the end by the time we got to under-14s. So he taught me something there about constant improvement, obviously celebrating success of individuals, but also the team as well. My rugby coach, John Simonet, was a very different sort of a coach. He was very black and white, very strong in his messaging to us, but in a way that brought us all on board. We understood the system, we understood the task, and we were very motivated to implement that task. And I think in terms of how I am as a CEO, both my dad and my games teacher inform how I am, or at least try to be, as a CEO.
It's interesting, because speaking to Michael Duff, who's the manager at Cheltenham Town now, was a player under Sean Dyche with Burnley and went all the way up the ranks as a professional footballer. He talks about having, you know, no nonsense and de-BSing football players, in a way correcting, you know, collective standard, no favourites. But I suppose within that, it's similar to probably working here with your creative industry partly. You want that collective sort of equality, but then you also want to have people the freedom to have individual flair, as you would in a rugby game, particularly a fly half or someone like that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a great analogy, isn't it? Your company team to the football team, and how you want them to play. Mm. And I think SLG, being a very creative team, we want to allow individuals to express. We want them to do a metaphorical overhead kick, back heel, or whatever it is, step over. Without a shadow of a doubt, because that's the kind of company we are. But that probably wouldn't work in all businesses, where a probably more workmanlike approach is what is required.
Yes.
And the players that are brought on board reflect that.
Yeah, we wonder sometimes if we still have vestiges in every workplace of the sort of industrial area, don't we? Almost clocking in and out of the factory, and we expect our staff to deliver sort of 8 hours of solid work. But when you are in more cerebral, creative environment, it has to be a slightly different approach, isn't it?
It does, although actually I would count that by saying that there's still a discipline required in any kind of team, sport, club, or company. There's a sort of rigour that has to be holding everything together, within which creativity can be allowed to flourish, or other attributes according to the person.
Too much of a maverick who comes in once a week. And,
just complacency about timekeeping. So there is an undercurrent of kind of rigour within. And again, that would reflect back to my dad as a coach, and my games teacher at school as a coach, both of which there was discipline always.
One thing that's in sport, and we know this as kids growing up, learning it, we learn to walk and then we learn to try and play a sport, for example, and you will talk about your dad, and it resonates, you talk about his entrepreneurship, and he was completely risk averse, and you wonder if he had this explorer's gene that John Hudson was talking about, because people speculated that the sort of people who explore and adventure, in modern manifestation, often that can be entrepreneurial, because you're not worried about risk as much as other people normally would look at the worst case scenario. But he did that for a while till he got his success, which led to SLG, which is almost allied to sport, isn't it? Because you know, when you first play anything, you tend to be rubbish, which is a sort of misconception, because we always imagine that the best are sort of innately born like that.
Yes, absolutely. I think the thing is that curiosity of what is possible, a mindset toward what exists beyond what you know, is very important, both in business and in sport. So my father in business, I grew up in a house where my father, the business, the family business was at home. He was basically my dad, really. He was a sort of, I describe him as a sort of global Dell boy back in the day. He used to buy and sell stuff from all over the world to other countries in the world. Something from England that would sell to Nigeria, something from the Middle East that he'd import into the UK, and everything in between.
Just make a little bit of money on each item. And
everything, deals being cut everywhere. And always to pay for the next thing. I mean, it was quite hand-to-mouth, and it was prolific, and it was corned beef, tyres, beauty products, heraldic art. I mean, you name it, my dad traded it. It didn't really matter to him, as long as he could buy it for X and sell it for X times two, and that was all that mattered, really. And maybe in terms of sport and playing that into sport, you know, that player that seeks out the pass, the killer pass, is the same person that might be that entrepreneur.
Yeah, so you have to, you have to miss a few before you nail that one, yeah.
Yeah, and get over the fact you did fail a few times and then the greater good comes from that.
Yeah, because a lot of us carry those failures around, don't they, and impact the future stuff, whereas obviously your dad was able to just wipe the slate clean and crack on. But your mum must have been supportive in that, and she was influential in the breakthrough for SLG, wasn't she, which was makeup applicators, because I presume your dad wasn't necessarily a specialist in that.
It was a great husband and wife moment, that, you know, my dad was the business entrepreneur, my mum was very entrepreneurial too, and she used to travel around the world with him to trade fairs, spotting out products that could be interesting to import into the UK, or indeed might trigger an idea for something made in the UK, and that is what happened with the makeup sponge. My mum saw this particular makeup sponge. She said, this is going to be big. My dad said, oh, really? And she said, yes, trust me on this. And that moment led to this company we have today, really. So my dad set about creating that product in the UK, manufacturing the same thing that he'd seen at a trade fair in America, I think it was. And that gave birth to a company that actually had a longevity, because everything prior to that had been individual
transactional deals,
and you know, quite eclectic. And this seeded, and it embedded. The company got listings at Boots, I think was the first one, and that created ongoing business, and the company with a long-term future was born.
And then for you, you had the dynamic of ultimately working under your dad. You had adversity as well to deal with. You said to me in the past that you were sort of unemployed, and what has that taught you about? I don't know if you talk about having children as well in terms of building your empathy, but did that build a lot of empathy for people here who maybe had difficult times in their past? Because often nowadays with social media, we're looking for manicured CVs and histories, aren't we, sometimes?
Yes, absolutely. I left school at 16. I didn't do A-levels or university. I went to work. I worked for 10 years, or actually, no, about 8 years. Then I went travelling. I thought, yeah, there was some recession at the time in the UK, and I went travelling. I came back from travelling, and I just imagined that I would walk straight into a job. And it was a very humbling experience to find myself out of work for a number of months, and then realising that I could sign on the dole, which I didn't ever think was for people like me from a reasonably comfortable middle class background. Mm. And I somewhat reluctantly did that. I only received a couple of months of that sort of benefit. I never felt comfortable with it, actually. But what it did teach me was not to be complacent about success. The journey to success is fraught with hiccups, and it was a humbling experience. And since then, I've always remembered that. And anyone who comes to interview at SLG that doesn't have A-levels, doesn't have a degree, or had a period of unemployment, doesn't really matter to us, because it could actually be one of their greatest learning experiences, should be seen perhaps as a benefit.
Yeah, often people come out of difficult communities as well. They have sort of slight skirmishes with the law, potentially, things like that, but that was all part of the growing up. And I work with a lot of boxers, and it's almost inevitable to survive. They have to be in those sort of circles sometimes. And it's treating people, as we talked about, here and now, as they are rather than what they were.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, you need to have an awareness of where people have come from, what's occurred, but it can very easily be misread, something, a blot on the copybook in the past, when actually it could be seen as a positive, really. I think most of our board of directors, I think over half don't have a degree between us. And we have those that do, obviously.
Well, I think it's swinging back the other way now, isn't it? Because it was almost you're a decade older than me, but when I was going to university, there was a small fees, but it wasn't, is it anywhere near like £9,000, I think it is, year now. It's a big decision, whereas even in your generation, there were grants and things like that, weren't there? But I think it was probably rare, but maybe it's swinging back the other way, where people are having to evaluate whether it's, you know, quote-unquote worth going to university.
That's right, the rise of apprenticeships, you know, and what have you. And we have three sons, 18, 17, 14, so we're right in the midst of all of that. And my opinion is that they don't need to go to university necessarily, as long as they've got a clear plan of what they do want to do instead of. My wife's a little bit more academically orientated and feels that university is probably should be the default more. But we're playing through. My eldest is on a gap year, so he's kind of straddling between.
Is he going? Is he going away?
He is in Nepal as we speak. He arrived yesterday, so he's having that gap year.
How are you finding that? Is it a lot of worry?
I'm not terribly worried, because he's a very self-sufficient chap. He's very well travelled, actually, for a youngster. He's been on, his grandparents are Italian, so he's spent a lot of time travelling backwards and forwards to Italy on his own when he was younger. So he's fine. So no, I don't really worry too much, but I do miss him. that's for sure.
And that's interesting because you've had one of your sons. Is the same son for work experience? Is that
both different? Have been, but yeah. Luca was here for 5 weeks just before he left.
Yeah. The dynamic of not only coaching your kids' teams, being your dad's player at one point, then working for your dad and trying to kick on with the company, that's been a complex picture which people probably, even working with some people, work with their wives or husbands. How have you handled that dynamic of home and workplace?
Yeah, so both my sons have done work experience at SLG in the last few months, Luca particularly for 5 or 6 weeks. Absolutely fine. I wonder whether there's a honeymoon period whereby everything's working really great in that respect. You know, we walk in together, we chat about work on the way in, he does his work. We don't actually work together during those periods. And then we have lunch together and then we walk home together, yeah. And we chat about the day. And there's a huge thirst for knowledge from both my sons about the company. Mm. Now they've experienced working with it. So it's actually been very, very functional. How that might manifest if they were ever to work full time, different thing.
Yeah.
And I think it would be very incumbent on me, as it was with my father to myself, to give them the space to be themselves and not to be a father to them in the office at all. And yes, I learned an awful lot. When I joined the family business, my dad, literally the first day I walked in, he sort of walked out with his golf clubs on his shoulder and said, gave me some keys and said, good luck. You know, I think he, don't F it up, he might have said, but he left me to him.
You have to be comfortable with micro failures to play golf from my limited experience with that, to be fair. But it's interesting, you coach your boys at hockey as well. I suppose it's that dynamic when you've done well and you've built a big company, and it's just wanting them to, if they're a part of it, to earn it and not feel, to have the same sort of drive, I suppose, that you had going through that period of being unemployed in the sort of early stages of SLG where maybe it wasn't as established.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I when I joined the family business, it was quite small. It was 700,000 turnover, I think, and we had about 25, 30 employees, and there was only four of us in the office, which was myself, my dad, my dad's partner, Pat, who was the sort of financial director, and a secretary called Dawn. It was small, very small. My boys have come to work for a company in the last couple of months that has up to 120 people working in at any point in time, and it's global, and it's multi-millions of turnover. It's a very different sort of situation, really, for them to assess. And I don't know what that's like, because I never had that. I joined a different company.
Because you want them to develop the way that you did and sort of, you know, learn and kind of apply yourself.
Well, that's right. And we took, you know, I guess subconsciously, subliminally, we're teaching them values of, it doesn't matter who they work for, whether it's SLG one day or inevitably other companies, they would have learned from my approach, my wife's approach about discipline. I talked about that in terms of, you know, never being late, adopting the rules and regulations of the environment you work in and not challenging those, really. And working bloody hard, frankly. And I think they understand that for sure. Yeah. And that's why it's been very easy to work with them here. I think that was already in their DNA.
Yes,
yeah. Pretty much.
That's interesting, the DNA aspect of it as well, and that genes. Quickly on the, because your time is precious, you're a leader in this company, the Americana element to it, because I spent some time doing my master's in journalism in the States, always loved the States. There's downsides to it, there's a lot of poverty and polarity of incomes and things in the States, but there is something that sort of appealed to me as a sort of a slight liberation when you're there, of a possibility of, you know, if you want to go hang gliding, you can do it, or whatever it might be. There's less of the restrictions we talked about. Is that what appealed to you, particularly the skateboarding, West Coast culture? What was your...
Well, my wife and I love holidaying in the States, in particular in California, in particular Palm Springs, actually. We've got a particular thing for that. We also have a love of mid-century modernism, which Palm Springs is the kind of epicenter of that kind of design code.
And was it the Eames people, were they? They were more LA, were they?
Eames, I think, was LA.
Yeah.
But we've adopted a lot of mid-century modernism in furniture and design code in Studio 8, mixed in with a sort of urban street, kind of, you know, more LA street vibe with the skateboard kind of thing. So there's a bit of a fusion going on there. Mm. But the Americana and the Palm Springsy thing is definitely about escapism as well. I felt it was very important when you walked into SLG's offices that you felt some detachment from what you... were customary to,
yeah,
a sense of somewhere new, different, and opportunistic as well. And I think the Americana helps deliver on that, really.
Definitely a change of vibe from the lower end of the high street in Cheltenham. Actually, you step up, it's like stepping into a new world, which is great. It's been great to chat to you, Mars, and Just a final thought, which struck me, because you've been very successful here, you've done very well with the company, you've kept it in Cheltenham, which I think, or Gloucestershire, which I know you're predominantly based in Gloucester originally, which is just down the road, but you've founded this local community, which I think a lot of people are proud of when anyone does well locally. But I think the message that I get is that you're trying to be a nice guy, a kind man, and empathetic, and succeeding in business at the same time. Is that where we're going with things at the moment? You feel that it's kind of saying you can have and do both and actually be more productive as a company if you are understanding?
I don't consciously adopt that principle.
Yeah.
It's great to hear you say that. But I suppose in a way what it is, I want to be the boss the kind of boss that I might have had when I was employed.
Yes.
Maybe that's it. And maybe I'm an amalgam of some great bosses trying to take the best of those. And that would have definitely involved empathy and a human touch, I suppose. Maybe that's what's going on.
And you remember former members here as well, they've lost their lives, haven't you, as well, which I thought was actually elderly people, but it came to pass in our discussion that it was people in their 30s, which goes back to the well-being theme and just the importance of not just moving on too much sometimes.
Absolutely. We had a very sad to have lost three members of staff during the recent years to various illnesses, females, all of them actually 25, 39 and 40 year olds. And we were able to reference them, bring them into the building actually by way of some graffiti that appears on one of the columns in the office, where we tagged their names and so they're with us all the time. That was a very late stage idea. It just came to us and we thought, Christ, let's just do it, because we were conscious of three special people weren't going to be able to join us, but they're kind of with us now.
Great touch. Miles Dunkley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Guys, thank you for listening to the podcast as well. If you can rate it on iTunes, that would be fantastic. And we will speak to you again very soon. Thank you.